Chapter 31. Austin examined the satellite photograph through the magnifying glass and shook his head. He slid the picture and magnifier across his desk to Zavala. After studying the photo for a moment, Zavala said, "I can see a lake with a clearing on one side and some houses. Could be Nighthawk's village. There's a pier and some boats on the other side, but no airship hangar. Maybe it's hidden." "Maybe we're setting off on a fool's mission, old chum." "Wouldn't be the first time. Look at it this way. Max said this is the place, and I'd trust Max with my life." "You may have to," Austin said. He checked his watch. "Our plane will be ready in a couple of hours. We'd better get packed." "I never unpacked from my last trip," Zavala said. "See you at the airport." Austin did a quick turnaround at his boathouse and was heading out the door when he saw the light blinking on his telephone answering machine. He debated whether to listen to the message, but when he pushed the button, he was glad he did. Ben Nighthawk had called and left a phone number. Austin dropped his duffel bag and quickly punched out the number. "Man, am I glad to hear from you," Nighthawk said. "I've been waiting by the phone, hoping you'd call. I tried to get in touch with you a couple of times. Sorry for being such a jerk. That guy would have killed me if you hadn't stepped in. I wandered around and hung out with some pals, feeling sorry for myself. When I got back to my apartment, there was a message from Therry. She said that SOS was going off on its own. Ryan talked her into it, I guess. Damned fools, they'll get themselves killed. I feel the same way. I'm worried about my family, too. We've got to stop them. I'm willing to try, but I need your help."
"You've got it.
How soon can you leave?"
"Whenever you want me to."
"How about now? I'll pick you up on the way to the airport."
"I'll be ready."
After Zavala left the Numa building, he drove his 1961 Corvette convertible to his home in Arlington, Virginia. While the upstairs was spotless, as would be expected of someone who routinely dealt in microscopic tolerances, Zavala's basement looked like a cross between Captain Nemo's workshop and a redneck gas station. It was crammed with models of undersea craft, metal cutting tools, and piles of diagrams marked with greasy fingerprints. The one exception to the jumble was a locked metal cabinet where Zavala kept his collection of weaponry. Technically, Zavala was a marine engineer, but his duties on the special assignments team sometimes required firepower. Unlike Austin, who favored a custom-made Bowen revolver, Zavala employed whatever weapon was handy, usually with deadly efficiency. He eyed the collection of firearms in the cabinet, wondering what, short of a neutron bomb, would be effective against a ruthless multinational organization with its own private army, and reached for an Ithaca Model 37 repeating shotgun, the primary weapon used by the SEALs in Vietnam. He liked the idea that the shotgun could be fired almost like an automatic weapon. Zavala carefully packed the shotgun and an ample supply of ammunition into a case, and before long, he was on his way to Dulles Airport. He drove with the top down, savoring the ride because he knew it would be his last in the vet until his assignment was over. He pulled up to a hangar in an out-of-the-way corner of the airport where a crew of mechanics was doing last-minute checks on a Numa executive jet. He kissed the Corvette's fender and said a sad goodbye, then climbed aboard the plane. Zavala was going over his flight plan when Austin arrived a short time later with Ben Nighthawk in tow. Austin introduced the young Indian to Zavala. Nighthawk glanced around as if he were looking for something. "Don't worry," Austin said, noting the expression of consternation on Nighthawk's face. "Joe just looks like a bandit. He really does know how to fly a plane."
"That's right," Zavala said, looking up from his clipboard. "I've passed a correspondence course, all except for the part about the landing."
The last thing Austin wanted was to have Ben bolt from the plane in fright. "Joe likes to kid around," he said.
"I wasn't worried about that. It's... well, is this all there is? I mean, just us?"
Zavala's lips turned up in a smile.
"We hear a lot of that sort of thing," he said, recalling Becker's skepticism when he and Austin had arrived to rescue the Danish sailors. "I'm starting to get an inferiority complex."
This isn't a suicide squadron, Austin said. We'll pick up some extra muscle on the way. In the meantime, just make yourself comfortable. There's coffee in that carafe. I'll assist Joe in the cockpit. They were quickly cleared for takeoff and the plane headed north. At a cruising speed of 500 miles an hour, they were over the waters of the Gulf of St. Lawrence in a little over 3 hours. They touched down at a small coastal airport. Rudy Gunn had checked earlier and found that there was a NUMA survey ship working in the Gulf. The way had been smooth through Canadian customs, and before long, Austin, Zavala, and Ben were climbing aboard the ship which had come into port. By previous arrangement, the Navara was waiting 10 miles offshore. As they approached the yacht, Zavala eyed the long, sleek vessel with appreciation. "Pretty," he said. "And from her lines, I'd say she's fast, too. But she doesn't look tough enough to take on Oceanus." "Wait," Austin said, with a knowing smile. The Navara sent over a launch to pick them up. Aguirre was waiting on deck, his black beret, as usual, perched at a jaunty angle on his head. By his side were the two brawny men who had escorted Austin after he was plucked from the waters outside the Mermaid's Gate. "Good to see you again, Mr. Austin," Aguirre said, pumping Kurt's hand. "Glad you and your friends could make it aboard. These are my two sons, Diego and Pablo." It was the first time Austin had seen the two men smile, and he noted the resemblance to their father. He introduced Zavala and Nighthawk. The yacht was already underway by the time he and the others followed Aguirre's to his grand salon. Aguirre's motioned for the men to take a seat, and a steward appeared with hot drinks and sandwiches. Aguirre's asked them about their trip and waited patiently for them to finish their lunch before he picked up a remote control. At a click of a button, a section of wall slid up to reveal a giant screen. Another click and an aerial photograph filled the space. The photograph showed forests and water. Nighthawk sucked in his breath. "That's my lake. And my village. I used the coordinates Mr. Austin gave me and fed them into a commercial satellite," Aguirre said. "I'm puzzled, however. As you can see, there is no sign of this airship building that you mentioned." "We had the same problem with the satellite photos we looked at," Austin said. "But our computer model indicates that this is the place." Nighthawk rose and walked over to the screen. He pointed to a section of forest bordering the lake. "It's here. I know it is. Look, you can see where the woods have been cleared, and there's the pier." His confusion was evident. "But there's nothing but trees here where the blimp hangar should be." "Tell us again what you saw that night," Austin said. "The dome was huge, but we didn't see it until the airship appeared. The surface was covered with panels." "Panels?" Zavala said. "Yes, what you see on a geodesic dome, like the one they built for the Olympics in Montreal. Hundreds of sections." Zavala nodded. "I didn't think adaptive camouflage technology was that far advanced." "Sounds more like invisibility we're talking about," Austin said, gesturing toward the screen. "Not a bad guess. Adaptive camouflage is a new technique. The surface that you want to hide is blanketed with flat panels which sense the scenery and changing light. Then what the sensors see is displayed on the panels. If you were standing at ground level looking at this thing, all you would see is trees, so the dome would blend into the local forest. Someone obviously took satellite imaging into account. It would be a simple matter to project treetops on the roof panels." Austin shook his head. "Joe, you never cease to amaze me with your supply of arcane knowledge." "I think I read about it in Popular Mechanics." "Nonetheless, you may have solved the mystery," Aguirre said. "At night, the panels Mr. Zavala talked about could be programmed for the ambient darkness. Mr. Nighthawk saw more than was intended when the dome opened for the Zeppelin.
There's something else that might interest you. I saved photos taken earlier. Aguirre's went back through the memory bank and projected another aerial photo. This picture was taken of the area yesterday. There, in the corner, you see the outline of a small plane. I'll zoom in on that section. The picture of a float plane filled the entire screen. Four figures could be seen standing on the shore of the lake. The plane disappeared a short time after the photo was taken, but look here. Another image appeared showing a small boat with three people in it. One of them, a woman, was looking skyward as if she knew they were under surveillance from space. The Basque's sharp ears picked up the sound of Austin swearing under his breath. Aguirre raised his bushy eyebrows. I think I know who those people are, Austin said by way of explanation. And if I'm right, it could complicate things. How soon can we jump off? We are heading up the coast to a point that will enable you to go the shortest straight-line distance. 2 hours, maybe? In the meantime, I can show you what I have to offer. With his sons taking up the rear, Aguirre escorted the others down a companionway to a large, brightly lit below-decks helicopter hangar. We have two helicopters, he said. The civilian one on the stern we use for getting about. This Sea Cobra is held in reserve should the occasion arise. The Spanish Navy ordered a number of these aircraft. Through my connections, I was able to sidetrack one of them. It carries the standard armament. Aguirre sounded like a car salesman touting the extras for a Buick. Austin swept his eyes over the naval version of the Army Huey and the rocket and minigun pods slung under the stubby wings. The standard armament will do just fine. Very good, Aguirre said. My sons will accompany you and your friend in the Eurocopter, and the Sea Cobra will go along with you in case you need backup. He furrowed his brow. I'm concerned that someone smart enough to use such clever camouflage would have the best detection technology. You could be greeted by a welcoming party, and even a heavily armed helicopter would be vulnerable. I agree, Austin said. That's why we're going in by land. We'll put down at an abandoned logging camp, and Ben will guide us through the forest to our target. We think they will expect any intrusion to come across the lake as Ben did before, so we'll come in from behind. We'll escape the same way, hopefully, with Ben's family and friends. I like it. Simple in planning and execution. What do you do when you get to your target? Aguirre asked. That's the hard part, Austin replied. We don't have much other than Ben's account and the aerial photos. We'll have to improvise, but it wouldn't be the first time. Aguirre didn't seem worried. Well then, I suggest we get started. He signaled Diego, who went over to a phone next to a battery of switches. He spoke a few words, then began to punch buttons. There was the hum of motors, an alarm horn sounded, and doors in the ceiling slid slowly apart. Next, the floor started to move upward, and moments later, they and the helicopter were lifted up to the deck, where crewmen, alerted by the call, hurried in to prepare the Sea Cobra for action.